Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Gregory Lansky, bar registration number 38515, and I represent Mr. Michael Fisher. He's the appellant. Mr. Fisher, after a jury trial, was convicted of first-degree murder, felony murder, and is now currently serving a life without parole sentence. The issue of this for this appeal concerns the denial of his post-conviction claims. The first claim on appeal deals with the issue of conflict of interest and whether or not Mr. Fisher's public defenders were laboring under a conflict of interest during the pendency of his proceedings. And there's three components of this claim. One is the issue of the law, the applicable law and legal framework at the time of Mr. Fisher's proceedings, which was back in 1996 to 1998. The issue whether or not his attorneys in the public defender's office acted in conformity to the law as in effect during that period of time, whether because of that, that resulted in the conflict of interest. And although the Colorado Supreme Court Castro says you really don't need to have a fine of adverse effect, there still was an adverse effect, you know, in their representation. So let me begin first with the applicable law as it stood during the time of Mr. Fisher's proceedings. I think the best place, I think the issue really is whether or not imputed disqualification applies to public defenders. And I think the best place to start is Rule 1.10, the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct, as was in effect during that time, imputed disqualification. And then clearly it states that the definition of a firm includes legal service organizations and legal aid. I think by the express terms of that rule of imputed disqualification, I think the public defender's office, imputed disqualification does apply to the public defender's office.
Mr. Lansky, don't you have to have an actual conflict first?
Well, the conflict here was the endorsed representation of the endorsed witness of the state, Mark Sartori, of the other Denver Public Defender's Office.
But as I understand it, the thing that we're trying to avoid is the use of information adverse to the interest of the defendant. And as I understand the record here, that just didn't happen.
That's correct, but the conflict, because of their belief of the applicable law, that conflict could apply in this situation, because of the concurrent representation of the Denver Public Defender's Office and the Adams County Public Defender's Office, they were materially limited by that understanding to that client, to that loyalty to the client, and also to their own personal interests. It's Rule 1.7b, whether there may be a material limitation as a result their belief in the conflict with the endorsed witness, which was being concurrently represented by the other regional public defender's office. And that's the concern here in this case, is that they were acting under the assumption that this was a conflict, and that was the correct interpretation of the law at that time.
Didn't they both testify at the 35C hearing that despite this memorandum about a potential conflict, they didn't believe there was an actual conflict, and they didn't think it would have or had any effect on their representation?
But the problem with that is that they believed it was a potential conflict. And the Colorado Supreme Court says, I mean, that memorandum says potential conflict, and they said, we don't think, and I emphasize think, it's not going to affect our, you know, our representation. It's clear the Colorado Supreme Court, both in Castro and Edinburgh, says, I mean, once you know there either is an actual conflict or a potential conflict, you have to disclose that to the client. You have to disclose that to the court.
Okay, but we're now in post-conviction world, and you're not saying that the minute there was some potential conflict at trial or trial counsel thought there was, it's game over on 35C, that a defendant automatically gets a new trial.
Well, I think you have to show, you know, although Castro, you know, says you really don't have to show adverse effect, you have to show there's a possibility that it could have adversely affected the proceedings. And that's what I was arguing here, is that they were operating on the assumption that this was a potential conflict. And as a result of that, they took certain actions in this case. You know, those actions considered of setting up a Chinese wall with the Denver Public Defender's Office. The investigator indicated during the hearing that she did not do stuff for Mark Sartori as she would normally do for other witnesses. This all stuff which affected their representation. And also, if you look at when this witness actually testified at the trial, he took the Fifth Amendment, and then they didn't properly object to that. You know, and then they say, well, our strategies were where we wanted that statement in, although then they tried to impeach his statement when the detective testified as to that statement by saying, well, wasn't he offered immunity in order to get that statement? And yet they did not, and then they did not present those other three convictions, you know, which were very relevant to their defense because Mr. Fisher was being represented, was charged with a co-defendant, Bill Polanco, and the theory of defense was Bill Polanco was really, you know, he was the person who did the shooting. He was really the ringleader in this. Mark Saratori had a very close relationship with Bill Polanco. Bill Polanco called Mark Saratori to go with Mr. Fisher to destroy the car. It was argued, it was insinuated that Mr. Fisher did not, on his own free will, try to set this car ablaze after this incident occurred. So clearly, by showing these prior convictions, the aggravated robbery convictions where Mark Saratori and Bill Polanco were co-defendants, Mark Saratori was using the actual gun that was used in this incident, in this case, the theft of car case or mobile case, which happened in Lakewood, where in fact that 2 days after this incident occurred, Mark Saratori gives the car to Bill Polanco so he could flee the jurisdiction. And in addition, and the drug case, the Denver case itself, what's important about that case, how it's related to all this, is that his statement, Mark Saratori's statement to Detective Lynch, occurred during the Denver case. In fact, if you look at Exhibit D, it was the Denver file, which the public defenders did not get. Mark Saratori asked for counsel, did not want to speak to a law enforcement district attorney's office. And that was done in the public defender's, on their own form. And it was signed by the public defender. So clearly, if they wanted to attack the reliability of this statement, you know, they had the option to do that, but they did not do that. And the reason was because they were acting on the assumption that there was a potential conflict, there was a conflict. And they had issues of loyalty, they also had issues whether or not they didn't want to have any inferences of impropriety on their part. And that's where the material limitation comes in for Rule 1.7b. What I also think is very crucial in this situation is the fact that all these actions, and all those other cases too, besides the Denver case, the Adams County case, and the Goldman office, the Jefferson County case, they put a momentum, conflict off this case. Mark Saratori is an endorsed witness in our case, conflict off, which further shows that they believe this was a conflict. And with all this going on, and Mr. Fisher being tried on a case where he's facing life in jail without any possibility of parole, he was kept in the dark about this. You know, that's when the case of Ragusa comes in. People view Ragusa with a counsel of choice. You know, clearly did not have a counsel of choice there. And I submitted, I just discovered a new case, People v. Delgadillo, which was, I think, decided by the Court of Appeals here on March 1st of 2012, which says, where you can find adverse inference, an adverse effect on attorney's performance is the failure to disclose a conflict. And that's exactly what happened in this situation.
Back up to the point on which you started, and then we sort of went off on actual conflict. You were talking, I believe, about how disqualification among these public defender regional offices would be imputed. All right, let me start over. That you could impute the disqualification of one public defender to the others in different regional offices. I'm not articulating this very well, but this is the rule before Shari, in exactly. Other words. I know there were cases before Shari that talked about public defenders within the same office being disqualified and between the appellate division and the trial division. Are there any that involve public defenders in different regional offices?
Not that I'm aware of. But if you read the comments to Rule 1.10, it allows that possibility.
Well, tell me about that, because the Attorney General has, on page 10 of the answer brief, cited a comment to then-existing Rule 1.10 that says, lawyers employed in the same unit of a legal service organization constitute a firm, but not necessarily those employed in separate units.
The key there is not necessarily, which means it can be, and it is a case-by-case analysis. And if you look at the testimony of attorney Mulligan, who was one of Mr. Fisher's attorney at the evidentiary hearing, at 35C hearing, he indicated it was the office policy, you know, that if there was another regional office that has an endorsed witness, they had a conflict off. That was the policy there, and that was the practice, and that's exactly which was done in this case. And that was based on the way the ethical rules and the law at that time was written. And so they're being, you know, they're interpreting the rules, you know, to avoid any liability about that. And that's why there was a conflict here. And because now this was a consideration of you know, the attorneys, when dealing with Mark Saratori, this was an impermissible consideration. You know, this is, again, a first-degree murder case. I think higher scrutiny needs to be here. I think there's also an issue whether the integrity of the proceedings are, you know, at stake here. This should have been disclosed. There's considerations here. The attorneys testified as to their strategy regards to Mark's territory, but we don't know whether that strategy was affected by these impermissible considerations. We know there was a delay, at least, you know, based upon the other witnesses that were investigated, there was a delay regards to Mark Sartori's investigation. We know that his court files and prior convictions were not taken. They were done into other witnesses, other state witnesses in this case. There's issues about how they conducted their examination during trial, why they didn't object to him taking the fifth. There's all issues here, you know, all inferences here that, you know, maybe they were concerned of any inferences of impropriety because the way the laws were written at that time. And that just should not have been done in Mr. Fisher's case. Any other questions as the first issue on appeal? No? Okay. I just want to briefly touch now on the last issue. I think it's an interesting issue with regards to the aggravated robbery being the predicate felony for the felony murder, whether or not it constitutes a crime of violence. And I think, you know, because it is essentially a per se crime of violence, I think the court should have discretion pursuant to the crime of violence statute to, if it wanted to go below the mandatory minimum on this case because it meets all the requirements of a crime of violence. The state does not plead any differently because of the fact that it is a crime of violence, the aggravated robbery. And I think for policy considerations, I think, you know, if there's ever a situation where the court should use its discretion in unusual and extenuating circumstances to lower the sentence below the statutory minimum, I think a felony murder conviction is the one where the court should have that discretion. I mean, this is where, you know, other jurisdictions don't even have the felony murder statute because of the lack of intent that's necessary for a conviction. Other jurisdictions, which I cite in the reply brief, indicate that, you know, the court does have discretion to do a second-degree murder as opposed to a first-degree murder. I think in this situation, for policy, you know, considerations, I think this court should, you know, and this when it meets the requirements of the crime of violence statute, I think it would be fitting and appropriate and sensible to give the court a discretion to lower the life without parole sentence. I mean, there's also an equal protection issue here because when you have a second-degree murder conviction, it is a crime of violence, and the court has some discretion there. And for a crime for second degree murder, you have to have an intent to actually kill someone. That intent is not there for a felony murder conviction. Yet the court does not have the discretion to lower the statutory sentence in a first degree murder case. And with that, I don't know if the court has any questions as to that issue. Nope. Okay, with that, I reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Lansky.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Majid Yazdi, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. As Judge Vogt pointed out, there are two separate issues and there are steps to be taken before we get to the resolution of this issue, whether the imputed disqualification or conflict can be applied to the defendants and to defense counsel in this case. The first question is whether PD's representation of a defendant, if there's conflict of interest, whether that conflict of interest automatically is imputed to the other attorneys in the same office. That's one issue. The second and a more difficult issue is whether, under the same circumstances, that conflict of interest is automatically, again, imputed to all the attorneys in the public defender's office. In other words, statewide disqualification of all the attorneys. I think the Shari case actually answers the second question, which is the relevant question to this case, conclusively by saying no, because it does not constitute this qualification does not apply to other offices. It is not, whether we define it as a firm or as a different entity is not relevant to this issue, because even under Rule 1.10, if it is considered a firm, that does not necessarily make the whole state agency as a firm. It would be still limited to the local and regional office in which those attorneys had the conflict of interest. But jumping from that to the bigger question, which is the more relevant question here, and the key question here, is a long leap from that. And there is no case that goes against this position that Shari case has taken. And under the current rules, this is clearly not the case that any conflict of interest would be automatically imputed to attorneys in other regional offices, which was the case here. The defendant in this case relies on cases that were decided under the old and obsolete Code of Professional Conduct, the Allen case, Rodriguez case, and as the Shari case points out, there's a distinction between those cases and the cases decided under the Rules of Professional Conduct, which is what the Shari case has done. Under that case, these conflict of interests do not automatically are not automatically imputed to attorneys in other regional offices or local offices.
Okay, but didn't the rules about imputed disqualification change between the time of the defendant's trial and the time that he was before the court in post-conviction proceedings?
The rules were in effect in 1993, Rules of Professional Conduct.
Are you saying that Rules 1.10 and 1.11 were the same in 93 as they were when Shari was decided?
On this particular issue, I don't think there has been any material change that would affect the outcome of the case. Another distinction, which also is not clearly distinguished in the opening brief and in the argument, is the distinction between potential and actual conflict. This is a fundamental distinction. There is no basis for arguing that there was an actual conflict in this case. The witness was not actually a key witness here. There was no contemporaneous representation by any other office when the trial was going on, although there was only a 4 months overlap. Mr. Serratore was designated as endorsed as a witness in October of 1996. And the case, the Denver case, which supposedly creates the conflict of interest, was concluded by February of 1997. And the defendant, Mr. Fisher, was tried in late 1997. So almost a year before even the trial took place, the actual trial took place, that case had been completed by then. There was no basis for any actual conflict. And the memorandum, which is the several memorandum or communications that were relied in the opening brief and extensively presented, they all referred to potential conflict. So what happened, these defense counsel, as in abundance of caution, they tried to create a Chinese wall just to make sure that any confidential information from the other cases are not revealed to them. That is a remote possibility of potential conflict that they tried to avoid. But that does not create any actual conflict in the case. And that distinction is significant both in terms of whether a waiver was required or not, and also whether there is any basis for disqualification. Harlan is clear that if there's a potential conflict, waiver may be required or may not be required. Whereas if it's actual conflict, then an express waiver would be required. So again, the cases that deal with Allen, Rodriguez, they deal with actual conflicts in the same local office.
Mr. Serratore, what was the status of Mr. Serratore's trial when he testified?
His case had been completed. He had received sentence on that case.
He'd been sentenced. Yes. Was it on appeal?
I I'm not sure about that.
Did the PD's offices, the other regional offices, continue to have a duty of loyalty to Mr. Ceratori at that point when Mr. Ceratori is testifying?
Again, based on my recollection of the record, since the case had been closed, sentence had been completed, I don't think there was any basis for any conflict of loyalty. And another explanation for the behavior of defense counsel in this case is that as they testified in the post-conviction hearings, they really didn't think Mr. Ceratori was a critical witness, and whatever he had to say was not even necessarily incriminating to the defendant, because he was only involved in the destruction of the vehicle in which the shooting had been occurred. He was not an eyewitness. He was not a participant in the murder itself. He was simply an accessory after the fact. And they tried actually to minimize Mr. Fisher's liability by saying that he was not, the defense strategy was to show that he was not involved felony murder, because he was not planning, he was not involved in the planning of that. He was simply wanted to commit a theft. This was not inconsistent with Mr. Ceratori's testimony that they destroyed the evidence after that. So defense counsel specifically said they didn't think it would be that damaging to have Mr. Ceratori's testimony, and that is why he was not considered to be a key witness. He was not interviewed initially because it wasn't considered to be a significant piece of evidence, and whatever he had to do was considered to be not inconsistent with defense strategy.
Isn't that part of what our concern is when there's a conflict or a potential conflict, that the strategy will be somehow influenced, whether it's conscious or not, that the strategy of the defense counsel will be affected by this perception of of a split loyalty?
Your Honor, or in this case, are you suggesting there is any evidence that they perceived any actual?
Well, generally speaking, first of all, can we take for granted that the strategy they came up with, didn't matter? And second of all, was there any evidence to the contrary?
I think generally, again, given the crime, the circumstances of the crime, and the role of Mr. Ceratori, the limited role that he had, I think it is safe to assume that it was not affecting the strategy, because the strategy was clearly based on the evidence before the jury. And the best strategy that they could come up with was to say he wasn't involved in the planning of the murder. He just was going along with the theft, and his co-defendant basically decided to shoot. So whether Mr. Ceratori would testify or not, or how he would testify, could not have affected that strategy. This was the best strategy that the defense could come up with, independently of any testimony by Mr. Ceratori. And again, as to the record itself, they specifically said they didn't consider him to be a key witness, an important witness, and that is why he was not even interviewed initially. And I guess at one point, maybe there was, here I'm not sure about the record, whether they actually met him in prison or not, but one of the criticisms and one of the arguments is that because the interview was delayed, that was a reflection of being concerned about any conflict of interest, and that was not the case. They simply did not consider him to be an important witness, so they didn't want to spend resources on that. Otherwise, 20 other people had been listed as potential witnesses.
And this was their testimony.
In the post-conviction.
In the post-conviction.
Yes.
And the court found them credible.
Yes. And the court concluded that although there was the potential conflict of interest, it was never developed into an actual conflict of interest. And I think the record and law supports that ruling. And we ask the court to affirm the court's order denying the criminal 35C motion. On this, the court has any questions?
I do have a question about the sentencing issue to which Mr. Lansky alluded. defendant's motion was captioned a motion pursuant to Crim P 35B. Were his motions timely? And if they weren't, why didn't you argue that they were untimely in your brief?
Actually, the motion for sentence reduction was based on the statute, the crime of violence statute.
And is there no time limit for raising such a motion under the statute? I mean, for seeking reduction of your sentence under the crime of violence statute?
I'm afraid I don't have the answer to that.
Okay.
But definitely, because first-degree murder is not a crime of violence, and because defendant was not charged with any crimes of violence, then that statute would not apply. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yossi. Mr. Lansky, you have about 2 minutes and 14 seconds.
Okay. Just to respond to Judge Floyd's last question, no. There is no time limit for the crime of violence statute. All the statute says is 90 days. Within 90 days, the DOC has to submit a report, and any change of sentence has to be effective after 120 days. So there's no limitation like a 35B, which says it has to be done in 120 days. Back to the first issue on appeal. I think the key word that the state just said was, it's safe to assume that it didn't affect their strategy. I mean, this is exactly the concern Holloway and Edibles has, is that we can at this point make any assumptions how it affected or did not affect their strategy. What we do know is that they had this understanding that there was a potential conflict of interest. All their acts were done in conformity with that understanding. And now we're speculating that, well, he was not a very important witness. Clearly, destroying evidence after the fact is an inculpatory act. But more importantly, whatever the strategy was, whether to impeach that statement or to show that Mr. Servitori had a relationship with Bill Polanco, a close relationship, and they were both violent, those prior convictions were all relevant to either of those strategies, and they were not provided at all during the testimony. And that's the problem that this court has in what happened during the proceedings, that we don't know because of their consciousness, their consideration that there is this potential conflict flowing out there. There is this paper trail of all this conflict stuff. There's the note from the investigator that this conflict was discovered back in December of 1996, right when this case started, and they sat on this conflict so long. How do we know that this was not a consideration? And this court is not in a position to make these assumptions, and neither is the state to say, we're assuming that it did not have an effect. The court can't do that, but we know there was an impermissible consideration in Mr. Fisher's case, and that should not have happened.
What are we to do with the trial court's finding that the defense counsel who testified it didn't affect their representation were credible?
Well, it's not an issue of Strickland analysis. It's an issue of whether or not there was a conflict. That's it.
So we disregard the trial court's findings regarding the credibility of defense counsel?
Well, you can find them credible, but they weren't clear as to their strategy. They said, well, look at Attorney Morgan's last statement in his testimony. He says, yeah, it's consistent with trying to impeach him, and it's also consistent with trying to group them together with Bill Polanco and Marcus Terry, saying that they're both violent and they had a close relationship. This court is not in a position to make those assumptions. It was wrong. It should have been disclosed to Mr. Fisher. He didn't have the choice of counsel, a constitutional choice of counsel, and I ask this court to reverse his conviction.
And Mr. Lansky, and what's your position with regard to the requirement that there be prejudice? Is that a requirement or is it not?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's not it. If anything, Castro says the issue is adverse effect. Adverse effect can be shown by their actions, by not disclosing it, and also about what happened during the trial itself. But Castro says there doesn't need to be an adverse effect, just a possibility of an adverse effect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lansky. Thank you again, Mr. Yosti. Your arguments were excellent this afternoon. They were helpful to us. We appreciate them. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.